Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. So whether you're tuning in live or catching up later, stay ahead with some of the stories that really count. Coming up on this edition, Africa throws open its doors with a bold new tourism pitch, but the competition is ratcheting up. South Africans are drowning in debt just to get by. Investors return as Johannesburg's inner city fights back, and banks scramble as deepfakes blur the truth and there is more fraud. It's Thursday, the 15th of May. Africa's premier tourism showcase is now in full swing in Durban. The 2025 edition of Africa's Travel Indaba has officially declared the continent unlimited and open for business. And some impressive figures here: over 1,300 exhibitors from 27 African nations, more than 1,200 vetted buyers, and the message is clear. Africa wants a bigger piece of the global tourism pie. But behind the slogans and the ribbon cutting lies a tougher question, I think. Are we ready to deliver on that promise? The continent and South Africa. I'm joined now by Daryl Erasmus, Chief Operations Officer at South African Tourism. So, Daryl, welcome. Unlimited Africa is a bold theme, but what does it practically mean for a tourist who wants to book a trip today?
Under the theme Unlimited Africa, we're really trying to bring together a diversity, I suppose, a tapestry of all the product that exists across the continent. And as you rightly pointed out in your opening remarks, we have in the region of 1,300 exhibitors here. And again, you know, coming from 27 different African countries, those 1,000 exhibitors you spoke of represent 55 global countries. And they've all converged in Durban in the last 2 or 3 days. In order to do business, and for us, these are great numbers. We have all indications are that, you know, we're going to surpass last year's numbers. And I think at the end of business yesterday, we had concluded in the region of almost 28,000 business meetings on the floor here at Africa's Travel Indaba. So I think what that does is give context to the interest that there is from a global community perspective in the tourism product across Africa. And as South African Tourism, who are the owners of the show, a couple of years ago, we made a very strategic decision to turn this into a very authentic but also intentional Pan-African show, because as much as South Africa and South African Tourism wants to benefit from the tourism dollar and obviously the contribution of tourism to the economy, it's important that the continent comes along the journey with us, because, you know, as a regional from a regional perspective, often tourists travel to South Africa, but they don't only travel to South Africa when they come to this part of the world, because it's so remote and obviously a long-haul destination. So very conscious and very intentional decision on our part to position this as the premier show on the continent, specifically focusing on Africa. And as I said, you know, all indications are we've surpassed last year's numbers, and a very good sign for us in terms of how people are searching for product on the continent.
So a lot of bullish sentiment. That is encouraging to hear. But Daryl, we've heard a lot of promises around growth before, but South Africa's tourism arrivals are still below 2019 levels. Why should we believe that it's different anytime this time?
So your comment is correct. In some of the inbound markets, we are still behind, but there are some markets that are ahead. We have anticipation that, you know, inbound countries like Australia are going to surpass 2019 numbers this year. There's a number of our European markets that have already surpassed those numbers, as has the US. So there's a sentiment that we are behind, but as I said, in some of our inbound and our legacy inbound markets, we've actually surpassed those numbers. And a very interesting fact I'm sure your listeners will find interesting is that at the moment, 75% of our international arrivals actually comes from the continent of Africa. Again, reinforcing why a show like Africa's Travel Indaba is so important for us as South African Tourism.
You want to attract, if I'm correct, 1 million more international air arrivals annually, but you're still plagued by visa problems and air access issues. They have plagued the sector in the past. Is there any encouragement on your side that this is going to change anytime soon?
Absolutely. So as recently as this year, the trusted tour operator system, which has been rolled out by the Department of Home Affairs, is already starting to facilitate ease of travel from a visa perspective between key markets like India and China. And I know that the Department of Home Affairs is far along the journey in terms of getting to a point where they launch the electronic visas. And that will most certainly unlock additional arrivals for us as a country. I think added to that, we acknowledge that, again, being a long and a, you know, long-haul destination, airlines and airlift are critical to the success of the destination, obviously, to unlocking additional arrivals. And the government of South Africa has already adopted a route development strategy, which is in its infancy and being rolled out as we speak, to find incentives and other ways of encouraging new airlines to adopt routes and hopefully direct routes to South Africa. So both of those two are being addressed very pragmatically, but also making sure that we align to the strategic priorities that have been given to us and we've aligned to from a government of national unity perspective.
All well and good, but I would also suggest to you, Darryl, that crime and infrastructure failure remain key deterrents. What's your honest view on whether we are competitive with other global destinations right now if those two issues are still problematic?
I think to speak from my perspective, to speak to the concept or the topic of crime, you know, I'm very fortunate to be somebody who is very well traveled globally. And you don't often find any destinations that don't have some element of crime when you travel globally. And I think and the meetings that I've had with a number of our different stakeholders here on the floor at Africa's Travel Indaba is about sharing very, you know, honest and accurate information about Destination South Africa and making sure that that information is being shared widely with the trade in our inbound markets, but also the actual traveler. So when they come to South Africa, they're very well equipped and holistically understand, you know, where they should be going, where they should not be going, and what they should potentially avoid if there's a risk of any, you know, petty crime and so on. So for us, it's about the distribution and dissemination of really accurate and up-to-date information to try and eliminate and to try and minimize the impacts of those kind of things on our tourism's market.
It is encouraging to see that ambitious job creation targets have been set, but practically, where are those jobs going to come from and how are they going to be sustained?
So to give you an idea, Africa's Travel Indaba in Durban last year created over 1,000 jobs just from one single event. So you see the magnitude of the kind of business events that happen across the country can have. The economic impact last year, the direct economic impact for the city of Durban for Africa's Travel Indaba was in the region of 230 million. And that's not simply just for the tourism value chain, hotels and transportation and so on. That spills over into the extended value chain and the extended participants for small businesses. And that's exactly where those job creations happening. We also have here at Africa's Travel Indaba a sustainability village where we invite local artists, local crafters to come and we give them space at the venue to come and really share with the world, 55 international countries, their wares and their products, and give them market access. And again, that's creating, you know, revenue streams and creating jobs. So it's a very intentional focus for us as tourism, as the tourism sector, to really get to a point where we are actively engaging in community tourism and transferring the benefit of tourism to communities and creating those much needed jobs.
Darryl Erasmus is the Chief Operations Officer at South African Tourism. Thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, South Africans may be feeling a little more upbeat these days, but their bank balances are telling a different story. There's new data out from Debtbusters that shows more people than ever are relying on personal and payday loans to survive. And listen to this, a staggering 91% of people applying for debt counselling in the first quarter of this year had a personal loan. Even high earners are falling into deeper unsecured debt, with top income groups using nearly 80% of their take-home pay to just service debt. So what do we learn from this? Well, the cost of living really is crushing. And while confidence may be ticking up, I think reality is ticking a little louder. So let's turn our attention now to a regular guest on this program, Benai Sega, Executive Head of Debtbusters. And Benai, how can consumer confidence, I wonder, be rising, and welcome to you, when personal loan use is hitting record highs? There seems to be a contradiction there.
Thank you, Jeremy. Always nice to be back on the show. It is interesting because going into 2025, we were all feeling much more confident, buoyant about where the economy would head. And of course, in the last 3 months, things have changed. So, a few things. One is that we're talking about Q1 2025 debt index, and some of the personal loans that we have seen would have been originated before that when people were potentially feeling more confident. But at the same time, I think people, when they do feel more confident about the future, they also don't mind spending. I think part of it is that a lot of the things that have happened over the last few years, steady inflation, tax brackets not really changing, all of that has really put a lot of pressure on the consumers' pockets. So I think particularly with top earners, the answer seems to be, they tend to borrow not just for themselves, but also a number of family members because they're generally the top earners and they're the ones eligible for getting loans. And I think that's what you're seeing, particularly on the top end.
Let's talk about those top earners, that real spike in debt to income ratio. Do you think it's lifestyle inflation, economic pressure, or an uncomfortable blend of the two?
I'm going to go with the latter. It's an uncomfortable blend, and I think it's probably a bit elephant in the room. We are faced with difficult choices every day, particularly like if you think about that group, often they will start with, let's say, a private school for their kids, which generally at the beginning may not be that different in terms of pricing compared to a state school. And over the years, as we say, okay, this is the way to go, it becomes more and more expensive, but you're already in the system. So it's quite difficult to pull yourself out. And I think what we're seeing is that if you look at what the money is spent with that group in particular, many of the expenditure items, if you look at the budgets more carefully, many of the items would have attracted an inflation rate that is far higher than what the CPI, as published by Stats SA, has been over the last several years. So as a result, for example, medical aid and things like that, they generally rise at a faster pace compared to the CPI. And I think the pressures of that are definitely very evident on that income group.
The one percentage that I find quite concerning is 91% of people applying for debt counseling in Q1 had a personal loan. Do you think it's a sign of financial mismanagement on their part or sheer desperation, as we've already outlined?
I think I would say it's probably desperation and also availability. I think personal loans are pretty easy to get, often online, and you get the money in your bank account rather quickly, often in the same day. So if you are short of cash and you believe that this route is easier, and I think most people do believe is easier than making some difficult lifestyle changes or choices, then you're going to go this route. And I think we've definitely seen that. It's the fact that people need it. One thing we don't have, Jeremy, in the report, but I have seen from the National Credit Regulator actually, is the percentage of people who get declined when they apply for loans. That has shot up. Now it's 2/3 of loan applications are being declined compared to a few years ago, which was around 55%. It's a huge increase. And not only that, but also the volume of demand for loans has gone up significantly since the pandemic. So what this is telling us is there's big demand from the South African consumer, probably because it's driven by pressures economically, but also the fact that incomes haven't really grown in terms of what people are taking home. I think all of these things are combining to paint the picture that we're looking at today.
What's more horrific is that debt servicing is eating up 70% of income on average. That says to me that we're very close to or have reached a personal debt collapse in this country.
Yeah, I think many countries openly talk about the cost of living crisis, in the likes of US and UK, and they have been for the last several years. We haven't really spoken openly in South Africa about the cost of living crisis, but we do have one in our own way that has become worse over the last few years. But ours has been driven particularly by, what the price of regulated things have become. What are those? It's the rates that you pay to your municipality. It's the electricity price that you pay to Eskom. It's the petrol price that you pay at the pump. All of these things are regulated. And they've really sort of eaten away in terms of what we have in terms of disposable income. And I think the response has been let's borrow more to make up the shortfall. But the borrowing has also shifted to more expensive, shorter-term type debt. And that's why you're seeing 70% of take-home pays being needed to resurface this debt.
What's also worrying is the role that food inflation is playing, particularly for lower income earners. And if I've read the survey correctly, they are facing a 2 to 4% higher inflation than the average, and the pressure on there must be enormous and insidious.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as we said earlier on the show, CPI is the average. And I think, you know, when we look at CPI, we say, okay, I don't really see myself in the CPI because I feel like my expenses have gone up a lot more than 2.9% or 3% or 4%, whatever it might be. And I think particularly for low-income groups, because they have to spend a disproportionately high percentage of their take-home pay on food, and food prices have been rising steadily over the last 3 years, they're definitely feeling something more than what the CPI indicates, and they definitely feel it straight away.
You've also raised a red flag around balloon payments and vehicle financing traps. What are you saying, and do you think there should be tighter regulation in that respect?
Yeah, we have definitely seen some things that we would prefer were not there. So firstly, the size of the balloon payments has increased over the last few years. And this is, you know, as a result of vehicle prices becoming higher and higher. We have to remember there's significant tariffs, since tariffs are topical, there's significant tariffs that we face when we have most of our cars are imported from elsewhere. So as a result, the cost to the consumer has gone up a lot more than what the consumers can afford. So in response, I think what the vehicle financiers have done is keep the monthly repayments more or less the same that they were 4 or 5 years ago, because that's what people can afford, but push more of the cost to the balloon payment further down in the capital and adjust the interest rate. And as a result, we are seeing larger balloons. We are seeing more vehicle with balloon payments. And I think it's something that should feature. If you are financing a vehicle, you really need to think about it, and it should feature in your life in terms of how you're considering whether or how to finance your vehicle.
It is a very sobering survey. Ben Isega, thank you very much indeed. Executive Head at DebtBusters.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, it seems that Johannesburg's CBD is getting a new lease on life, and savvy property investors, I'm told, are already circling. That's thanks to the city's new inner city revitalization plan, which aims to transform derelict buildings into viable commercial and residential assets. I guess all of this has got to be welcomed. So let's find out a little bit more with Ricardo Silva, managing director at Galetti Auction. And he says demand is already picking up in hotspots like Germiston, in Maboneng, and also in Melrose. So, Ricardo, a very warm welcome. I'm wondering, first of all, why investors need to believe in an inner city comeback. There have been so many years of decline, haven't there?
Yeah, I think there has. And I think there's, you know, with the decline, there's also been, you know, a renewed interest. And, you know, I think that the Joburg CBD is very cyclic. You know, sometimes, you know, you get a revitalization, and then it happens, you know, that, you know, a lot of investors are buying, and then, you know, it almost goes on a decline again, you know. And I think it's got a lot to do with, you know, investor confidence and, you know, with the way that things are moving, you know. And I think there's no hard and fast rule, but at the moment, I think we are on the upward cycle as far as the inner city is concerned.
I'm going to wear my naysayer's hat for one more question, and I'm going to say to you that the CBD has serious structural and safety issues. Of that, there is no doubt. Again, why should an investor take the risk here?
I can't agree with you more. You know, you can't hide from the fact that the there's a lot of disrepair in the CBD. Why I would invest in it, and I always look at it from my point of view, is coming down to, again, the returns. You know, the hustle and bustle of the CBD, the returns are astronomical. You know, if you're looking at buying a building in sort of Linden, Johannesburg, you know, the returns that you're getting, you're going to be buying it at around an 11% yield. You know, if you're looking at Joburg CBD, you're looking at probably, you know, purchasing a property and at an 18 to 20% return. So as an investor, that's where I want to put my money. Is there some, you know, sort of hair and makeup that you need to be doing to get the building up and running? Absolutely.
But you will agree it's long-term ROI, though. You're not going to make money instantly.
I think, you know, in Joburg CBD, you definitely, you know, make your money a lot quicker, but it's a high-risk investment. You know, what we're finding at the moment is that guys are coming to our auction platform. They're bidding on a property at a relatively higher value, and they expect to see their returns, within 3 years, at an 18% return. Whereas if you're buying in sort of your more established areas, guys have a more long-term view on their property purchases.
So how real is the investor interest, Ricardo, that you're seeing? Is it mostly local, or is there a sniff of international interest here?
I would say it's probably split down the middle. I think there's a lot of guys that are very much committed to Joburg CBD. One being Gerald Alitsky. If anyone knows the city, they know that he's got Gundy Square, and anything around there is premium, and very well looked after. And then you get a lot of it foreign investment. Guys that are speculating, and I talk about foreign investment, coming from Africa, where guys see a lot of opportunity. South Africa is still viewed as a relatively safe space to put your money, which, we're seeing a lot of at, on our auction platform.
You've listed properties, I think I said at the beginning of our conversation, in Germiston and in Maboneng, for instance. What would make those two particular nodes so hot right now?
Look, Germiston is a great industrial node. It's also, got a lot of interest, far and wide as far as hotspots are concerned. So Germiston's got a lot of residential. It's very heavily focused in industrial. We've got an auction happening on the 28th of May at the end of the month, where we've probably got maybe 12 properties, whether that's industrial or residential, coming up in Germiston. So there seems to be a lot of interest there, but these are, liquidation properties and willing sellers. If you look at Maboneng, Maboneng was one of the areas that we saw really take an upward cycle, and now it's almost, sort of getting on the decline, well, has been on the decline for 3 years. But we're seeing a renewed interest in that node. The streets are a lot cleaner. There's a lot of security there. So it's a good investment.
And Ricardo, when we talk about usage, is the demand mostly from your perspective, logistics and industrial, or, and maybe leading on from the Maboneng example that you've just given us, is there still an appetite for creative or mixed use when it comes to property?
I would say definitely. Maboneng and CBDs, there's a huge interest in, mixed use developments. A lot of guys are buying these old buildings, revitalizing them to put student accommodation or convert to nice residential conversion. So, there's a big interest in the CBD to do those types of things. Within the Germiston area, the industrial properties, industry is booming at the moment, with, mining seeming on the upward cycle. There seems to be a lot of people moving into the likes of Calverwell and Ruedecorp. And by the very nature of that, there needs to be people that are going to be living in the areas. So it's a one hand washes the other type of scenario.
If Johannesburg gets this right, and as residents, we all hope that the city does, what do you think the inner city could look like in, 3 to 5 years from now?
Look, if I'm being very optimistic, I'd say it's probably going to be the new Sandton City. However, I think it's going to take a little bit longer than the 3 to 5 years. There needs to be really conscious effort from government to make sure that the upliftment of the area is not something just spoken about, but it's actually something that's followed through with. Stuff like the roads, there's a lot of stuff that needs to be done as far as, the government is concerned. But it also takes a lot of, landlords and owners to make sure that they also, putting a positive impact in that area. So 3 to 5 years, I think it's going to be a lot different to what it looks like now. I would say it's probably going to be an eight years until we can actually see a really, really a big difference in that area.
And I think you've hit the nail on the head when you say that it all comes down to what local government is going to do about this and the reality of the situation. And unless that changes, and particularly around maybe the city council of Johannesburg and the city administration, confidence continues to be shaky at best.
Yeah, look, I think it's time for the government to put their money where their mouth is. It's all good and well saying that we're going to do this and we're going to do that. The reality is that the road that it exploded 3-4 years ago, you look at other countries, and that those things are fixed very, very quickly. To sit there for even longer than 6 months, it really is disappointing. So I think the government plays a huge role in seeing where we're going to be at in the next 3 to 5 years.
And that's where we're going to leave it. Ricardo Silva, Managing Director of Galetti Auction, I appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday. for all your up-to-date stories.
In an age where your next scam might come with a convincing video of, say, Elon Musk or even your bank's chief financial officer, welcome to the world of deep fakes. The Momentum Group has raised the alarm on a sharp increase in sophisticated impersonation scams where AI-generated content is mimicking real executives to lure unsuspecting investors. Fake WhatsApp groups, phony Facebook pages, the threat is real. And let me tell you, it is spreading fast. So let me give you a broader perspective on this. I'm joined by Ravi Govender, who's Group Digital and Technology Officer at Momentum. And I want to talk about the risks, the red flags, and what you can do to avoid being duped. So Ravi, a very warm welcome. How serious is this deep fake threat right now, particularly for banks and financial institutions?
Thank you very much for having me, Jeremy. This is something that is becoming a much bigger issue, not just for banks and financial institutions, but of course for people at large. Technology accelerating at the pace that it is, we are now enabled with wonderful tools to enable us to do wonderful, magical things ever faster. However, as I think is always the case, the minute you have these tools, there will be some who will try and use them for the worst ends. And at this point in time, we're seeing a significant rise in these scams that are being used to try and sadly lift money off unsuspecting South Africans who are hoping that this is a genuine investment scheme.
What exactly makes these AI-generated schemes so convincing? I'm wondering if it's the visuals, if it's the voice, or maybe even a combination of both of them, because having seen them myself, the quality is extraordinarily good, isn't it?
I think that those are two key drivers, Jeremy. I think that we are still in a world where seeing is supposed to be believing. And we are very cautious around trying to give people advice on how do you spot these deep fakes, particularly those which are visual, because we find that the technology is advancing so quickly that even elements such as looking out for synchronicity of the lips to the voice, etc., are starting to change. But I think that it would be remiss to put all of the emphasis on the quality of the fake or the scam, and to not think about the desperation that a lot of people currently feel from a financial perspective, where I know we say if it's too good to be true, it probably is. But if you are in a position where you are desperately looking for alternatives, even a mirage may look extremely promising. And sadly, it is the combination, I think, then of the quality of the fake and the desperation of people for it to be true.
And it's the desperation, Ravi, that's the psychological hook then, isn't it? Because that's why people are falling for these kind of messages.
And not just falling for it, but being pushed into doing and taking these steps as quickly as possible. Because the idea is that you do not want to miss out. So it's that speed that then adds to it, because we feel that there is absolutely a voice in people's head that's telling them, hold on a second, something's not right here. And what we're often finding is very soon after making these deposits, we're getting contacted by clients then or potential clients or individuals who were drawn in by our brand name. They're contacting us almost immediately to say, we just wanted to check this. So clearly there was something that was bothering them, but they unfortunately got the contact in the wrong order. They ought to have contacted us first, or we hope in future they will contact us first so we can confirm or put them on the right track in terms of whether this is real or not.
So I'm wondering if there's a foolproof way then for the average person to spot a deep fake or this fraudulent outreach beyond the kind of just trust your gut.
Sure. Look, I think the trust your gut should not be underestimated. I do think that one of the safest things to look at is that if it seems too good to be true, it usually is. And that is usually the starting point. However, we recommend a few things. Before being pushed into an action, there are people that you can talk to. If you have a financial advisor, that should always be your first point of contact. Secondly, the brand that's being used or companies that have been used, it's quite easy to be able to get the contact details for those organizations and to be able to contact them. And ourselves at Momentum, we do have contact details on our website that can be used. And last but not least, the good thing about South Africa is that we're a highly regulated industry, and therefore licenses are required. And the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, the FSCA, has a very stringent process around that and make available contact details for the public to be able to contact them to ask a question. And there's also search tools on their websites to be able to ensure that they are dealing with an accredited license provider or accredited financial advisor.
Fair point about the regulators and particularly the Financial Services Conduct Authority, but are they battling to keep up with these tech-driven scams, given that they're becoming more and more sophisticated almost day by day?
I think, Jeremy, everybody is. I think it would be unfair to just point to the regulators, and therefore it's fundamentally important that all stakeholders in the ecosystem play closely together and work closely together to be able to identify these risks, identify these trends. And we find the regulators in South Africa to be highly collaborative in terms of talking to us and making sure that we have mutual learning environments where anything we find, we're able to let them know and vice versa. So I think we're all doing our best to be able to keep at the forefront of understanding these trends and then being able to warn the public of this. Mm. Unfortunately, this is going to always be a question of faster mice and better mousetraps. And we will always, unfortunately, be responding to threats as we see them. But I think the combination of the financial services providers and the regulators working closely together will always be a good idea.
I'll just need a quick answer to this. What about social media platforms? Are they cooperating fast enough when the scams are reported?
They certainly do their best. As with all social media platforms, if a takedown is asked for, they do need to go and check on this, because at the same time, you don't want that to be abused. But we certainly work closely with them, and there's always a way of trying to speed up our processes with them as well.
Ravi Govender, thank you very much indeed. Group Digital and Technology Officer at Momentum. And that is MoneyWeb at midday for today. We are live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.